This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, back for his annual visit to the program is good friend Dr. Jeff Andreessen. He's a state climatologist from Michigan. He's also a professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, it's always good to see you for several reasons, among which is the fact that each spring, the weather starts to warm a little bit, but that has not been particularly true this spring after, what, I guess a brutal winter?
Brutal would be maybe not in some cases do it justice, but a lot to talk about, it's good to be back, even if it is talking about some less than comfortable weather anyway over the last several months.
Well, let's talk a bit about the winter. We heard a lot about this thing called the polar vortex. It was a brutal winter. Give us the facts.
Well, and this is something I think to start off with that we could probably all look at and say a few years down or many years down the road that we experienced the winter of 2013-2014. In a historical context, it's way up there in terms of the records that we have, roughly 150 years. But in some ways, the beginning of this pattern, the beginning of the winter, actually go all the way back to before Thanksgiving in November. And the direct physical cause of our really cold winter was an unusually, and I put an underline on that, an extremely unusual upper air pattern that persisted basically almost 5 months. It finally broke up after just a couple of breaks for a couple days. There was one before Christmas, there was one after New Year, there was one in February, but even after a couple days, we came back to the same pattern. That in itself is extremely unusual, and it is the direct cause of the cold air. And so if we go back and we look at mean temperatures in Michigan across the state, we had below normal temperatures from November through March, and actually now probably April will be added to that as well. The last time we had a five-month November through March period that cold, 1911-1912. So we got to go back over 100 years, and that includes some really nasty winters, some of the late 70s, and some of the 1930s. It was colder than all of those. And we were on that list now in terms of our records. We're fourth coldest for that period. The other records, of course, there were some locations that set records for the most snowfall in a season. That was especially true in the southeastern part of the state. The most, the greatest number of days with consecutive snow cover on the ground, the most water equivalent in the snowpack. Wow. It goes on and on. The number of days below zero, we set new records for that, a large number. It just, we ran out of superlatives, really, to describe. So what we have seen is something extremely unusual, and even more unusual in that it counters a longer-term trend towards milder winters, and that goes back several decades. So what to make of this year, again, at least in terms of a climatological context, besides being off the charts, it's just extremely unusual. And while it was happening, of course, we heard a lot about the polar vortex, just basically a technical name for the circulation of the jet stream around both the north and south hemisphere. But in the top part of that, or the high latitude part, we have an Arctic circulation, and that's what was being referred to. The strange thing about it was, though, that again, the same pattern with a big trough over central and eastern North America, it just stayed there over and over, and that's something we just rarely, almost never, ever see. And the other interesting thing about that is as cold as it was here, and over, the Midwest and the Northeast.
Mention, what about in Europe?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They had one of the mildest, if not the mildest, winter.
Because they were on the other side of the air pattern.
That's right. They were underneath one of the ridges. The same thing happened to some extent over the western United States and Alaska. They had a very, very warm winters there. And if you average everything off globally, even, again, as cold as we were, January and I saw now March were the fourth warmest those months on record globally.
If you look globally.
Right. So it is a little bit of a net zero sum game, but it's like the real estate adage, it's about location. And being underneath one of those features, you can be relatively very cold or very, very warm. What was so, again, unusual about it was the persistence. We just never see something like that. Usually the jet stream pattern is continually changing. It's dynamic. We might see a few weeks of a particular type of pattern, but this one, even with a couple of breaks, it just kept coming back.
There was no winter thaw that we typically have.
No,
there was absolutely none.
And so, again, you think about our snow cover here. It's maybe the late 70s for those old enough like me to remember some of those winters in the Midwest, but really nothing else in recent memory like this. And even now, statistically, we've gone beyond those years too in many ways. The other part of this that I'm sure you're aware, the Great Lakes ice cover is, we were second in terms of the most coverage on the lakes. We were just behind 1979. We've got about 50 years of data. But for now, we still have over 30% of the Great Lakes covered by ice.
Wow.
Most of it's on Lake Superior. That is probably a record. That hasn't happened for much longer, at least 50 years, maybe more like a century. So strange to say the least.
The impact of that ice cover, I've read some conflicting things this year about what that means for lake levels.
Well, it's in some ways, it's been a positive because the presence of ice acts as a cover on the lakes, and it actually it certainly reduces, if not prevents, evaporation during the winter. And of course, with the last few decades, with milder temperatures in the winter, we've seen an increase in evaporation off the lakes during the winter, and at least that's part of our low lake levels. So a lot of it has to do with precipitation patterns as well. But certainly for the last half year, there's no question that it's helped. And lake levels have responded pretty quickly. And throw on top above average precipitation, and we've had a significant jump. We're still below normal on most of the lakes, but we're certainly more respectable than we have been over the last couple of years.
You may use the same source, but I do look at the Army Corps of Engineer data on the Great Lakes, and the numbers have been up throughout the winter, and they're projecting that they'll come up a little bit higher as that ice pack continues to melt up in Lake Superior.
Right, and the way we're going, and given our outlook, it's possible we may still have ice in Lake Superior, Memorial Day, maybe even beyond that. It's, again, something it just hasn't been seen for a long time.
Well, one of your favorite subjects and mine is the impact of all of this climate on agriculture, mm-hmm. meteorology. The ice pack, the cold winter, the snowpack, the snowfall, what does all that mean for Michigan's agriculture?
Well, it depends on the crop. It depends on the person that you talk to, a mix. But in some ways, start off with the negative impacts. As you remember, we had, there were five major Arctic outbreaks of severe cold. The first one of those came right after New Year and was accompanied by strong winds, which is also something very unusual. Combined with the effects of those Arctic outbreaks, we did have some damage to overwintering vegetation. Tree fruit, wine grapes, perhaps. It's not clear yet because, of course, most of those crops haven't come out of dormancy yet. But it's fairly likely that we have sustained some type of butter tissue damage. That is not very common here in Michigan. A lot of times because the Great Lakes mm-hmm. moderate or buffer, but
the
with ice cover,
sure.
we had pure Arctic air mm-hmm. with no moderation. So we have had some damage there. We've also had a more recent freeze as well. But on the other side of the coin, for those same crops, especially the tree fruit and our overwintering perennials, these cold late winters and early springs, they suppress the beginning stages of development in the spring. And that's a good thing. As far as the growers are concerned, the longer, the farther they can delay that beginning of growth, the less susceptible those crops are to spring freezes, which are typically the greatest threat to production year to year. And so in that way, this year has been fairly good. It's we've had one cold outbreak again that caused problems recently, but not like we see in a typical year where the crop is already active and growing and is more vulnerable. So that is a positive. We had a great deal of snowfall, and with all the snowpack, our soil temperatures remained above where they typically are. They're warmer than normal. Snow is a great insulator. And so even with all of the snow on the ground, a lot of that melted evenly and went into the ground. And, of course, that's a positive for later on.
So soil moisture is pretty good.
Exactly. And it actually probably, even though we did have some flooding reported around the state, it could have been much, much worse given how much water we had on the landscape. But it was a fairly even, orderly type of snow melt, and that's a great thing, too. So that may play a role here later on. Some types of overwintering insects and possibly disease pathogens that were above the snow line could have been taken out by the cold temperatures. Of course, on the other hand, those that remain in the soil had a nice cozy insulated blanket on top of them, so they probably would have higher than rates of survival. But overall, there was some good and bad, and I think now we're looking at the delays that this late winter has caused. That's right now probably at the top of the list. For people are nervous about trying to get some work done here and have been delayed with the cool, wet weather.
My guest is Dr. Jeff Andreessen. He's the state climatologist for Michigan. Jeff, for those of us who are not in agriculture on a day-to-day basis, homeowners, what impact is that going to have? We had your colleague Kevin Franken talking about golf courses and lawns, but other things that may impact people as a result of this brutal winter that we've been through.
Well, I think the one number one, probably without question, on most people's list is going to be energy costs. And when you go, and I've unfortunately have seen my own bill, and it just it's the largest bills that we've ever had, and we tried to keep the thermostat down. So directly for most people, it will be heating costs over the winter, which were probably higher than they've ever been before. That would be near the top list. The other one, which would be indirect, a lot of our municipalities, townships, have way overspent their budgets on winter snow removal, salt, et cetera. That of course,
or even pipes bursting in
right,
the water system.
And you can count me as one of those. I found out just recently one of my outer spigots had burst, and it was probably some owner. Operator fault, but involved in that, but still, no, that was
one of those things about not draining the
didn't yep. get all the water out of there and like I should have, and this year paid for it. Most years I wouldn't have it wouldn't have mattered, but this year, of course, with an extreme, it did, and that's happened. We've had a lot of reports about that. Other places where snow had been removed, such as roads or sidewalks, we had real deep frost layers. So in some parts of the state up north, where it was even colder, we had pipes bursting underneath pavement or underneath roads. That's another major need for resources publicly to have those repaired or fixed. So there's a lot of those, and as you can, a lot of those probably are not in the positive category. Those are costs that people have one way or the other, directly or indirectly, that we have to pay.
Jeff, I know you look at long-term trends, and you don't like to look at one specific season as sort of a precursor for any projections for the future. But is it likely, I mean, just your gut on this, or unlikely that we would see something like this again in the near future as far as a winter like that?
Well, I'm a fairly risk-averse person, but I think you might have better odds putting your whole paycheck on double zero, Soaring Eagle or something along those lines. It would be very, very low. Statistically, this is something that just rarely, rarely ever happens, at least in one lifetime. I would say no. So, and given the trends, even less chance. So it's just one of those climate singularities that's sometimes referred to. It just out of nowhere, it's something very, very unusual. And that's what we've certainly experienced here for the last several months.
You know, I always like to talk to you about the larger debate on climate and climate change, and you know, I'll get your take, and you know, you've been pretty consistent on it. We just talked with a distinguished professor at Penn State University who's going to be speaking in Michigan in the next few weeks or so. He said, though, and I want to get your reaction on that, he said there's really, among scientists, there's no longer really any debate about human-induced climate change, not in the scientific community. There are still those out there who would deny that for political reasons or what have you. I mean, how would you respond? He said you can never be sure entirely in science, but for the most part, the debate is over.
I would say, by and large, I would agree with that. We could probably have some discussion about how much how much warming takes place, how fast. Those things are still, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there. But the general, the link, the footprint of human activity in our climate record, I would agree, it's there. It's fairly clear to see, and it's getting, unfortunately, it's looking like more of an issue with time. So I would agree with that. It's just we have to look at, again, some of the details, because they have great relevance and importance for human and natural systems as well.
Well, recently talking to some of your colleagues in the geography department who've spent a lot of time in China recently, they had some numbers on parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over in China, which are just staggering. And I mean, that's human-induced.
It is. It's human activity, and It's just, well, if we look at our geologic record, there's just no question. There is almost a one-to-one correlation between these gas concentrations and our temperature on the surface. It's happened before. It will happen again. But this one, there's a major human link or element that sets it apart. It was what happened millions of years ago.
Jeff, last question here, and one I also always ask you: what can we look for as we move into the spring and summertime?
Well, right now, at least for the near-term future, probably a little bit of a continuation of the cooler than normal pattern, maybe a little bit of wetter than normal as well, which is not the best situation for agriculture. Officially, there is no direction on our summer conditions here from the Climate Prediction Center at NOAA, basically the climatology scenario for both mean temperatures and precip. However, that said, there is strong empirical evidence based on heavy ice cover and on very cold winters that summers in Michigan that follow those tend to be cooler than normal. So if I were, this case, I were a betting man, right. I think I would probably hedge my bets towards the cooler
summer
than normal. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's always fun to talk to Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist for Michigan, also a member of the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, I hope you have a great spring and summer, despite the fact that it's going to be a little cooler. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
There's been much news the past few years about diseases which have afflicted the pollinating bees that are so vital to our ecosystem. What can we as homeowners and gardeners do to ensure that we're not contributing to the problem? Well, let's find out from Dr. David Smitley, MSU Professor of Entomology, whose work is funded in part by MSU Ag Bio Research. Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
For our listeners who may have been out of the country or on another planet for the last 3 or 4 years, give us a little background on the situation with the bees, Dave.
Well, honeybees have been in a decline situation for the last 20, 30 years. It's mainly because of a parasitic mite called the varroa mite and some bee diseases. So beekeepers have had a rough time. And, I think people are concerned about that because bees are so important for pollinating our fruits and vegetables.
And most people have a very positive perception of bees anyway and wouldn't do anything to want to contribute to that problem.
Right, right. And we want to preserve bees and other pollinators in the home landscape for sure.
Well, the things that have been afflicting the bees are being researched by people, entomologists like yourself. But has progress been made in terms of solving the problem?
Well, there's one problem that they really don't have the clear answer for, and that's one called colony collapse disorder, but they believe there are two or three bee diseases that are most responsible for that. And I think the interest in pesticides came in that the neonicotinoid pesticides may be playing a minor role in that colony collapse disorder, but it's not the most important cause.
Well, for homeowners like you, like me, like my great producer, Russ White, I mean, what can we do around our homes? We're getting into the spring here, and we're going to be planting flowers and doing a lot of things in our yard. What can we do as homeowners to make sure that we're not contributing to the bee problem?
Well, the most important thing is not to spray open flowers with an insecticide. So that's that's the most harmful situation for bees. And any products that you might use in the yard and garden, just make sure that you're not spraying open flowers. If you do that, then you'll be protecting the bees in your yard.
So you want, if you're going to use insecticides at all, then you want to do it before flowering or after flowering, I take it.
Right. That's one thing you could do. Let's say you have like a linden tree and you're worried about Japanese beetle. Don't spray them until after they're done flowering. So that would be, they flower in June. So if you wait until early July, which is when Japanese beetle starts anyways, then you'd be protecting the bees because the flowers would be all gone by that point.
Now, there may be some misinformation out there about when people go and pick up their plants from a local nursery or garden center. Those people, though, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but those people know what they're doing, and they don't use insecticides during flowering.
Right, exactly. And you know, the plants that you buy at the garden center are grown in greenhouses and nurseries, and there's no connection at all between nurseries and greenhouses and bee decline. So the plants you go and buy at the garden center are, I don't anticipate any problems for bees. They're safe to plant in your yard. As a matter of fact, that's a good thing. The more flowers that we plant, annual flowers, perennial flowers, trees and shrubs that flower, the better it is for pollinators and bees, including bumblebees and native bees.
So the message is that if you haven't been planting a lot of flowers recently, certainly plant a lot more this spring because that's going to help pollinators in and of itself.
Absolutely. That's going to help the bees.
Now, in terms of this broader issue of the bee decline, this is not just the United States, I take it. This is something that is a problem worldwide.
Yes, and they've looked at this carefully in Europe, especially the use of the neonicotinoids on some of the field crops like corn. And they're looking at very minute levels down to 5-10 parts per billion to see if it has any effect on bee behavior. And it can have some effects, but they still don't think that's the cause of bee decline. But they're looking at it real closely.
Now, for our listeners that may not be familiar with the term neonicotinoids, a little background on that.
It's a new generation
of pesticides.
Right. It's a new class of insecticides, new in the fact they've been used a lot the last 20, 30 years. The chemistry of these insecticides is similar to nicotine, so that's why nicotinoid is part of the term. And they're used widely in agriculture and in the home landscape because they're actually safer to use than the pesticides we had before them.
So this new generation was developed as a response to environmental concerns about some of the earlier generations of insecticides or pesticides.
Right. They're more selective than the insecticides we had before in the sense that they're more toxic to insects than they are to people.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Dr. David Smitley. He's an MSU professor of entomology. We're talking about something that we're all very familiar with, at least in some way, shape, or form, and that is the bees that pollinate our plants. Dave, why are bees so important to agriculture?
Well, all of our fruit crops and vegetable crops must be pollinated by bees. And, you know, one of the largest uses is the almond crop in California, where I think about 50% of all the commercial beehives in the U.S. get transported to California for that pollination season.
Wow.
And we wouldn't have fruits and vegetables if it wasn't for bees.
So what are these producers doing that need these bees, the almond growers in California, given the circumstances of the decline in some bee populations?
Well, there's still enough colonies to do all the pollination in California, but the beekeepers are losing more of their bees during the winter, and they're having trouble keeping as many colonies as they have in the past. There's maybe 20-30% greater mortality now than there was 10-20 years ago.
Does climate have anything to do with this? Is there any research that shows that climate change may be impacting not just bees but other insect populations as well?
Well, no, not really. I mean, you know, one of the problems honeybees in keeping honeybees is keeping them healthy during the winter. And if it's a cold winter, that can actually cause more problems. So in some senses, you know, climate change may be helpful to bees.
Dave, I know you've been working on some materials at Michigan State Universities, and some of your colleagues around the country have as well. But back to homeowners and what they should and shouldn't do, there are some educational materials out there that are available. Where can folks go to get those materials?
Well, you can get that from your MSU Extension office, or you can go to the My Garden website. And there's a couple bulletins there, that one of them that says how to protect pollinators in the home landscape. And that'll give you some tips, including if you have some plants that you need to protect, you can use an insecticidal soap or an oil product, which, as long as you spray them when the bees are not present, so like right after sunset or maybe first thing in the morning, the residue is not harmful to bees at all. So there's a few tips like that in the bulletin.
And another tip that we were talking about before we started this interview, but when people are out taking care of their lawns and their turf, what have you, for spring, there are some things they can do with respect to, for example, treating for grubs that are also beneficial to the bees.
Right, right. And that's going to be in the bulletin, too. It'll say if you have to spray for grubs. Fortunately, most people don't if they have a healthy lawn. But if you do, mow your lawn first so there's no dandelions or other flowering weeds present, and then that'll protect the bees.
You know, we tend to think of the bees hovering around our flowers and what have you. We forget the fact that there are flowering weeds as well.
Right. And that's actually good for bees. So, you know, the weedier your lawn is, the better it is for the bees.
Okay, I've been talking with Dave Smitley, MSU professor of entomology. And Dave, again, the final word for our homeowners and gardeners is in terms of protecting the bees.
Well, the plants you buy at the garden center are perfectly safe for bees. Just to make sure you don't spray open flowers with insecticide. That's the most important thing.
And even I can remember that. Okay. I've been talking with Dr. David Smitley. He's an MSU professor of entomology whose work is funded in part by MSU Ag Bio Research. Dave, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my first guest this week is a gentleman I met during my January Rose Bowl trip. His name is Larry Dick. He's an Orange County, California businessman. He also serves as an elected member of the Orange County Water Board and an appointed member of the Board of Directors of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Larry, a pleasure to meet you back in January, and now to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be visiting with you about water.
Water has always been a major issue in Southern California. I don't need to tell you that. Could you please give our listeners a bit of historical perspective and an overview of the work you do on those water boards you serve?
We've talked about it being best reflected as a bald-headed man with a full beard. Actually, production's great. It's just the distribution that's lousy. The reflection of that in reality in California is that all the people reside, not all, but the majority of the people reside south of Santa Barbara, and the majority of the water falls north of Santa Barbara. So we have a big supply of water up north and a not-so-big supply of water down south. So our job is to see what we can't do about answering the thirst of the 19 million people in the metropolitan service area down south. Metropolitan is the largest drinking water agency in the United States. It serves about 19 million people in six counties. That would be Ventura, Los Angeles, Orange County, San Diego County, Riverside, and San Bernardino County. Metropolitan itself has about 1,800 employees, annual budget of about $1,800,000. We serve client agencies and client cities. We're governed by a board of 37 directors. We have in the past sold as much as 2.3 million acre feet of water a year. Have capacity to serve maybe about 2.5 million acre feet of water a year. The issues, of course, are can we continue to access these waters which come from other sides of the state? We get water from the State Water Project, from the San Joaquin Delta, and we get water from the Colorado River. There are demands on the Colorado River that are significant. There are, in the minds of many, some rather arcane water laws that make it a challenge. There's the old joke about there's $1 million in cash on the table, and there's the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and a water lawyer in the room. The lights go out. Who took the money? Well, it's a trick question. In reality, there is no Santa Claus, there is no Easter Bunny, and there sure as heck isn't an out-of-work water lawyer. The Colorado River is the most litigious river in the United States. It has been litigated so often and continues to be that the watermaster is the Secretary of the Department of Interior. It's the only river in the country that enjoys that distinction. The actual distribution of the rights on that river began after about 100 years of the wettest years in the Colorado history, and so it's basically over-distributed, if you will. The State Water Project comes through a very fragile piece of geography known as the Delta, and there are many demands on that particular parcel of land and the waters that run through it. So, it's kind of challenging, but it's kind of fun. And thus far, if we're not winning, we're at least holding our own. But we look forward to actually winning as time goes forward.
Well, Larry, we were talking out in California. You mentioned that you have added in your area, that six-county area, about 3 million people or so since 1995, yet your water usage amazingly has remained pretty constant. How are you doing that?
Education, I think, is probably one of the best answers. Through the education, we're able to be more effective in water use efficiency. Certainly a big part of water use efficiency is what we would always think of as just ordinary conservation. You know, Turn the tap off while you brush your teeth. Turn the tap off while you're shaving. The simple things. The water use efficiency comes from developing low-use irrigation systems. Drip irrigation, the advanced technology on water timers and landscaping. Water brooms for cleaning industrial areas. We pay for a rebate. Metropolitan coordinates with the local retailer. We'll offer a rebate for high-efficiency washing machines, high-efficiency toilets. We will help underwrite the removal of turf if someone wants to put in artificial turf or go with a California-friendly landscaping. We invest in things like recycling. Another phrase I've stolen from someone else is that the largest river in California is recycling. If we can recycle more water, that means the demands for new water have been lessened. So it's been Metropolitan's policy that if we see a good project in one of the local areas that the city or the water agency is interested in doing, we'll underwrite it to a level of about $250 an acre foot. I am a big believer in the virtues of recycling. We use recycled water in California along the right-of-ways on freeways. We use it in golf courses. We use it in a lot of industrial applications where it's feasible. Using it, for example, to irrigate the lawn at your home is a little impractical because we don't enjoy a dual plumbing system that's sufficiently developed that will allow us to take that water and put it back into a neighborhood. But if you're ever out here and you see some water coming out of a purple pipe, don't drink it. That's the recycled water we use for golf course irrigation, etc. That conservation has been huge. And as I said, we'll underwrite it to the tune of about $250 an acre foot, because it relieves the pressure on Metropolitan to go out and find new sources of water, which are costing $600 to $800 an acre foot to find and develop. So we'll underwrite that with the city or district, and then as prices rise and the lines cross, as so to speak, we reduce that subsidy. When it reaches parity with Metropolitan's water prices, we eliminate the subsidy. And even if it doesn't cross, we eliminate the subsidy at a maximum of 18 or 20 years, depending on the program.
One thing we talked about earlier as well, when I was out in California, the $15 billion or so that you spent on infrastructure and programs, that has been paid for not by the federal government or the state government, but by the ratepayers, the citizens themselves. Is that true?
That's accurate. We have the driest year on record in California this year. We're in the middle of the third year of significant drought. Yet in Southern California, we have a water shortage alert. We are not on allocation. The monies we've spent to build reservoirs, and a specific example would be something like Diamond Valley Lake, which Metropolitan Water District built this side of the major fault lines, which in Southern California is a real nice place to have your water supply. It'll hold about 800,000 acre-feet of water, which will provide Metropolitan's customers with about 6 months' supply of water. So that's a real nice safety net to have. And that way we use that as part of our overall water management facilities. But it gives us a little bit of a safety net. Interestingly enough, as we talked about, the waters in Northern California, but because they have so much of it, they haven't invested in reservoirs and things of that nature. So when a drought like this occurs, they're really less prepared for it than Southern California is. During the 70s, the Metropolitan Water District actually was able to forego taking water from the State Water Project and just enhance their delivery from the Colorado River, allowing Northern California to keep the water that by treaty would have come to Southern California. And they actually built a pipeline across the Richmond Bridge and shipped water to Marin County, which is about to go bone dry. The concept of investing in infrastructure is important. That allows us to engage in the concept of a big gulp and a little sip. When there's a lot of water coming your way, you want to be able to put it away. Put it away in a reservoir, use conjunctive use programs, or utilize underground aquifers. And then when the weather is dry, like it is now, we try to sip and just use it sparingly and engage in environmental-friendly water use efficiency programs. So that's our big sip, little gulp infrastructure investment story in a nutshell.
There's something known, a lot of us in the Great Lakes area may not be familiar with. It's called the California Delta. It's pivotal. You mentioned that it's also fragile. There's a Bay Delta Conservation Project underway. Tell me a little bit about that.
The Delta is a gorgeous part of California. Sportsmen like it for fishing. There's a lot of farming's done up in that area. There are islands up there. When you think of an island, you think of something like, you know, Kona or Maui. But an island in the Delta is really a parcel of land that is actually below sea level, that are protected by dikes. And these are dikes that were built back in the gold rush days. And there's no real professional engineering involved. They just moved dirt and since subsequently started farming. And the subsidence, because it's peat-like soil, goes down and down and down. You can find islands that are 30 feet, 40 feet below sea level. It's a very delicate piece of geography up there. Now, why is that important? Well, because in the State Water Project, think of it as a multi-lane superhighway running north to south, delivering water from areas of plenty to areas of need. And this multi-lane freeway hits the Delta and becomes a two-lane dirt road. Because of a lot of pressures brought to bear that was never really completed as part of the state water project. They had in mind a peripheral canal that would have run around the delta. That was defeated, so it's never been completed. As a result, if there's an earthquake up there, there'll be a tremendous amount of damage. So the new plan, which has been thoroughly vetted and continues to be challenged and looked at from different angles, calls for pipes to actually run under the delta. That should be less intrusive to the environment and provide a stable way to bring water north to south. Part of the issue has been the delta smelt. The delta smelt is a fish that is on the endangered species list. So if the water situation is such that the fish are gathered in the northern end of the delta, under the new program, we can take from the southern end. If they happen to be at that point in the southern end, under the new program, we can take it from the north end. The Bay Delta Conservation Plan has had a lot of work put into it. The environmental impact reports have been worked upon. We have north of $200 million invested in science in order to approach this the appropriate way. And the plan itself is dedicated in the opening sentences as a project that has co-equal goals of delivering water to Southern California and being environmentally not benign, but beneficial. Ultimately, this is going to cost billions of dollars, but it's going to be beneficial not only to those of us who enjoy water from the State Water Project, but those who get federal waters, the Central Valley. The Central Valley farmers are just suffering so bad. There's cities with 45% unemployment. There's farmers that are having to stump trees. It'll break your heart if you drive up that part of the area. Drive down a road, you see a farmer that's farming land on both sides of the road. On the left, he's got state water, and he's got trees with a great deal of bounty. On the right-hand side of the road is the Federal Water Project, and it looks like they're just barely hanging on. Same tree, same farm, same farmer. The only difference is the rules and regulations and his access to water supply.
Larry, my last question, and it's primarily for our listeners, but, you know, based on what we've been talking about now and previously, sounds like Californians are solving their problems with water out there, are going to solve their problems, taking aggressive steps to do so. All this paranoia we hear or talk about up here in the Great Lakes area about water diversion to the southwest is, I take it from your comments, seems to be no more than Midwest paranoia.
Well, I wouldn't call it paranoia. I'd say we probably look at all that water with a lot of lust in our heart. But the truth of the matter is, when you talk about the state of California, over half the water that falls goes out to the ocean. About a sixth of the water in Northern California comes down to Southern California. About a third is used in Northern California, the Bay Area, that sort of thing. So with half of it still flowing to the ocean, some of which needs to so to do in order to protect fishes, et cetera, the fish. I think you're safe for the time being. Give us another 50 or 100 years. We may come look at that again.
I've been talking with Larry Dick. He's an Orange County, California businessman. He serves on the Orange County Water Board and on the Board of Directors of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Larry, it's been great talking to you now as it was back in January, and I look forward to my next visit out to Orange County, and we can sit down and continue this conversation.
Well, I'd look forward to that as well. Incidentally, I was kidding about the 100 years.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
My name is Michael Shingles, and I'm one of the orthopedic surgeons here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine.
This is MSU Today.
Here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine, we take care of the Michigan State University athletes, but we take care of our community as well. So here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine, we have four primary care or family practice sports medicine docs that work on almost every injury an athlete can have, from head injuries to cardiac injuries to musculoskeletal injuries. And then we have our three orthopedic surgeons here as well who work mostly on musculoskeletal injuries. As an orthopedic surgeon, obviously, I do surgery on different joints in the body, as far as the knee, the ankle, hips, shoulders, my favorite being knee surgery. We also work on fractures, broken bones, muscle injuries, a lot of musculoskeletal trauma. As a sports medicine doc, I work with different athletes of all ages, from peewee to high school to college, professional, and then middle-aged and elderly athletes, because in this society, sports are important and being active is important. So I do see a lot of variety of patients, which is one of the things I love about my practice. And the sports med aspect is trying to keep your patient or athlete healthy and allow them to participate in whatever their sport is for years, and to allow them to do that safely so that they can continue to participate in that sport for years, or in some cases to get them through high school or college sports and still let them have a healthy body when they're finished. So when you combine sports medicine with orthopedics, you have a pretty sometimes challenging but definitely enjoyable profession. One of the great things about working at Michigan State University is we have access to state-of-the-art facilities. We have one of the top radiology programs in the country where we can get almost any image or study that we need regarding the patient's injured extremity. We have top-notch musculoskeletal radiologists who understand how to get the best images and help us read these images to get the most out of them. We have a great training staff who has years of experience regarding treating injuries. And I have great partners who have treated just about every sport, from the Olympic sports all the way through the revenue sports, being hockey, basketball, and football. So a vast amount of experience in which to work with and treat athletes. So that's certainly a great plus here at Michigan State.
Dr. Shingle says rest is often the best remedy for most sports-related injuries.
Well, I always tell my patients, for a lot of injuries, you can play through an injury as long as it's not going to cause long-term problems. And the basic treatment for sprains and strains that are not going to be long-term problems that will heal, that you can play through, are rest, ice, and anti-inflammatories. And most athletes are okay with the anti-inflammatories and the ice, but they don't want to take the rest. They don't want to miss even a game. And sometimes you have to. You have to take a break and let your body recover. And part of the art of sports medicine, of course, is to decide when to take that rest. If it's at the beginning of a season, then often it's best to talk with your athlete and let them understand that if they take the rest now, they'll be able to compete later on at a higher level when it's going to be more important to them and potentially to their team. And sometimes when it's at the end of the season, for example, a Final Four or a Rose Bowl or a Super Bowl, you know, you sort of tough it through and make it through the season, because there'll be rest after, theoretically, that is.
The year-round nature of so many sports contributes to many athletes' sports injuries, says Dr. Shingles.
You know, it's springtime, and in the past when I was playing sports, when summer came, that was time off. There weren't all these camps. There weren't all these summer leagues. You had the summer to rest and relax. And sure, you played sports with your friends, played some baseball, but you took a break from everything else and your body recovered. Sports have become so competitive across the board that athletes aren't getting a break in the summer. There's summer camps for almost every sport. And now, if you're a basketball player or a soccer player, you can play year-round. There's leagues year-round. And most athletes, or some athletes at least, and athletes' parents, and to some extent coaches, like that. They want their athlete as prepared as possible to give them that chance to potentially play at a Division I A program or even make it to the pros. So what we're seeing once they get to a Division I A program in some situations is they have injuries or chronic overuse injuries that we see in our middle-aged patients. You have kids coming in that already have arthritis. You have kids coming in that have been playing on chronic injuries so long that it's starting to catch up on them. That's tough, because now how do you treat this kid or this athlete? Do you let them play with their arthritis that they're coming in with? Do you tell them that you worked so hard to get here, but you really shouldn't do anything else because potentially you're doing more harm to your body? It becomes a much more difficult problem that we haven't had to deal with before. Now to be drafted in the NFL or the NBA, they're doing a battery of MRIs and x-rays to look for those things because they're so prevalent.
If you're resuming your fitness activities with the onset of warmer spring weather, MSU Sports Medicine's Dr. Michael Shingles advises you to ease into it and to consider incorporating some cross-training into your routine.
For athletes that haven't done anything all winter and they're just starting to get back to a exercise routine, start off nice and slow. Slowly progress their amount of running, for example. If they've been running for years and they enjoy it, but they're starting to get some aches and pains in their joint, whether they've seen a physician before or not regarding this, to try and extend their career or activity as long as possible by cross-training. For example, if you're a runner and you enjoy running a lot of mileage, but you're not able to do what you did before, then cross-train with riding a bike or swimming, which is overall probably the best exercise on the weight-bearing joints, such as the hip, the knees, and the ankle, because you're not impacting those joints. You're not pounding on them as you take every step. Swimming takes that out of the equation. One of our strategies for an athlete that enjoys a sport, but they have been diagnosed with some early arthritis, which is a problem that we can't fix. We can't reverse the arthritis. Arthritis is loss of cartilage from a joint, and that will progress. The only thing that slows that progression down that's been proven with studies is keeping an optimal weight. Well, to keep an optimal weight, you need to eat well, but you also need to exercise to a certain degree. So while exercise can sometimes progress the arthritis, it's also very important for the rest of your body, your heart, your lungs, keeping your general health stable. It's also important for keeping your weight control. So finding an exercise program that works and doesn't exacerbate your pain from the arthritis is a good tool in order to meet all those goals.
For more information about MSU Sports Medicine, please visit sportsmed.msu.edu. Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.